This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Welcome to the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. Gough Whitlam passed away this week at the age of 98. He was Prime Minister of Australia from 1972 to 75 before he was dramatically sacked by Governor General John Kerr in the dismissal. Journalist Lee Hatcher was there for that dramatic moment and remembers both the man and his key achievements in office. This week we also talked about the case of Jacqueline Sparks, the young first-time mum who was involved in a car crash with a drug-affected driver. The accident killed her unborn baby and left her unable to have more children. The driver couldn't be charged for the death of the infant. We find out why and what can be done about it with Professor Michael Adams, Dean of Law at the University of Western Sydney. Christmas is just around the corner. Scott Pape, aka the Barefoot Investor, gives us some tips for how to limit the financial damage of the festive season. Colette Smart from Family Smart tackles the question of how we should respond when our kids tell us they want to quit something they've been learning. Do you give in, strike a deal, or make them stick it out for a set period? Sculpture by the Sea kicked off in Bondi this week. We'll hear from the festival founder and director, David Handley, on what's different this year and some of the ways the exhibition has surprised him. Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak is bound for Sydney, taking up an adjunct professorship at UTS. We'll find out how they lured him over. And Paulini burst onto the Australian music scene with the first series of Australian Idol back in 2003. She's now back with a new album and a single, and she's keen to share what she's been learning. All of that is coming up in the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. Now, don't forget you can download it from the Hope 103.2 website or subscribe on iTunes. Just search for Hope Media and select the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I'm Katrina Rowan. Thanks for listening. Former Prime Minister Gough Whitlam has passed away this morning in Sydney at the age of 98. It's a good innings, isn't it? His wife, Margaret, who was married to for 70 years, died in 2012. But he's survived by his four adult children. Now, he did start his life in Melbourne, but grew up here in Sydney on the North Shore and went to school at Knox. Whitlam was Prime Minister of Australia from 72 to 75 before being dismissed in dramatic fashion by Governor General Sir John Kerr in 1975. And he's still the only Australian Prime Minister to have been outed in that manner. Journalist and former host of Open House here, Lee Hatcher, was there at the dismissal. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Katrina. Lovely to talk.
It's a sad day, isn't it? But I know you've been very busy all day with interviews. You probably haven't really had a moment to think about it.
No, it's a busy day. Every day's busy. But, you know, I've just had a sense, excuse me, for a long time that this day was inevitably going to arrive. Gough was 98. And not at all well for a numbers of years. But according to people close to him, would still turn up to his office a couple of days a week and do some work. But I am feeling the weight of it today at the end of such an important and significant and, of course, controversial political life in our nation's history.
Well, take us back to 1975. I mean, this was obviously a very formative time for you. Can you tell us about your memories of that day?
Well, I'd probably start in the lead-up to the day, actually. I arrived in Canberra as a green 19-year-old reporter for the Macquarie Radio Network as their bureau chief, which I still shake my head at. I arrived on Budget Day 1975, and those who know their political history will know that that was the budget that was blocked ultimately by the opposition in the Senate, and I walked into a kind of an arena of constant rolling, cascading crisis.
It's amazing. So you really had sort of just arrived when all this unfolded.
Yeah. I arrived on day one of what became the constitutional crisis. And it just continued to escalate. There were no quiet days in Canberra. I was so shocked. I did Gough's last year and Fraser's first year, then went back numbers of years later and covered from the gallery Hawke's, Fraser's last year and Hawke's first year. And I thought, oh, there are quiet days in the gallery. I couldn't believe it because every day was this cascading crisis leading up to, of course, that memorable day. Now, Gough Whitlam, at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, had gone with his party's blessing to the Governor-General with a plan for a half-Senate election to break the constitutional crisis. And it was then that, as he arrived, Malcolm Fraser was waiting in a side room, and as the Labor Party constantly accused Sir John Kerr of doing, ambushed Gough Whitlam with a letter dismissing him, withdrawing his commission. And the place went, Canberra went absolutely nuts. Parliament House went nuts. I was sitting in my office doing, preparing a report for the 2 o'clock news for the Macquarie Network on this half cent election plan. And my cadet burst into the office and bashed down the door and said, expletive deleted, Gough's sacked. And we both took off.
Wow.
And you will know, people will know the old Parliament House, know King's Hall, the big kind of stately area between the two houses of Parliament. Normally a place where you just kind of cruise through and see who's chatting to whom and pick up a bit of political gossip, all very serene. On this particular day, I'll never forget, people were running, screaming through, shouting through King's Hall. No one had ever seen it. And one of the very interesting and the many interesting aspects of that day was this crowd of hundreds of people, Canberra people, who had spontaneously arrived at Parliament House. Now, they were there for the famous speech that Gough Whitlam gave, but no one knew that was, you know, by about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, no one knew that was going to happen. They just came as a very political town. It's a very Labor town. And people just had to be there for the action.
Yeah.
Now, usually the Governor-General's private secretary came to the front steps of Parliament House when an election was called, announcing the proclamation of the dissolution of Parliament. It's a formal thing to be done. And, you know, there were two men and their dog usually would attend that kind of ceremony. On this day, David Smith, the Governor-General's official secretary, arrived for the proclamation to be read with this seething crowd of hundreds of people, furious that Gough Whitlam had been sacked, and was absolutely drowned out. The proclamation ended with the words from the Governor-General, God save the Queen. And then Gough grabbed the microphone and began his now famous speech with those words.
Yes.
Well, may we say God save the Queen, because nothing will save the Governor-General. And the crowd went nuts. It's an amazing moment.
Oh, it was amazing. You were standing right next to him, less than a metre away for that.
Yes, Katrina, it's my only claim to fame. I'm in one of the very famous photos.
Yeah.
No one ever recognises me because I was so young. I was 20 years old by then. I'd grown a beard because I felt I needed to look older than I was in reality. So, yeah,
yes,
there's this very famous photo.
Well,
where it's David Smith, Gough Whitlam and me with the beard with the radio mic.
That's right. We can see that photo on our Facebook page. I put that up and we can see Lee's fluffy beard. It's struggling a little bit, that beard, isn't it?
That's right. Very 70s, Katrina.
Okay. Now, before I let you go, we can't remember Gough purely for the dismissal. So what did he actually achieve? Just really briefly, what did he achieve in government, Lee?
Oh, it's hard to be brief about it. There was this pent-up the demand for change within the Labor Party, and it became known as the program. So Gough brought this comprehensive program of policy to the 1972 election and swept out decades of conservative rule all through the Menzies, the Gorton and the McMahon era, brought in free university fees, ended conscription to Vietnam, enormous strides in foreign policy, recognised China, we were the first to do that, called a Royal Commission on Aboriginal Land Rights. Even that's when we got Advance Australia Fair as our national anthem that replaced God Save the Queen. You know, you could go on for half an hour.
It's a lot of social reforms in a very short time.
Yes,
because he brought in Medicare too, didn't he?
Absolutely. Medibank.
Yeah.
And also what I say is that he had an enormous influence on the politics of Australia as well. Lessons learnt through the rolling chaos that the Whitlam government became, culminating in the discipline, I mean, the dismissal. There was a greater sense of discipline, certainly within the Labor Party and in conservative ranks from then on. In fact, Troy Bramston, the Australian columnist, wrote a book on the Whitlam era's trail of influence on politics to today. No one ever wanted to revisit the hard lessons of chaos and ultimately the dismissal of the Whitlam government. There was a great sense of discipline and the need for decent economic management. It was a very, very great series of lessons for many politicians of both sides after that.
I'm speaking with Lee Hatcher, who was there at the dismissal in 1975. Just finally, Lee, as someone who did get up close to him, what were your impressions of the man personally?
Well, there was a book written called A Certain Grandeur about Gough Whitlam. Now, this is a personal comment, and I hasten to say not a political comment, but the man was physically large and absolutely commanded attention wherever he was. He had if ever there was presence, if ever there was gravitas, and not only through good, but also through controversy as well. There was no way that you'd miss him. He was an enormously the intellect and the capacity of the man was legendary, as was his legendary temper inside and outside cabinet. There was no one like Gough Whitlam, and I think he's remembered to this day. The media's gone nuts with this today, which I'm not at all surprised about. He had an enormous influence on that period, though he was in for just 3 years. Addition to that, he's always been considered the great Labour martyr who was dismissed, but many on the Conservative side of policy would say that was thoroughly deserved because of the chaos that the Whitlam government ended in. But there's no doubting the impact and the stature of Gough Whitlam on Australian politics.
Well, thank you, Lee, for sharing some of your insights with us today.
Pleasure, Katrina. Yeah. Lovely to talk.
Yeah, always. Lovely to reflect over it. It's journalist Lee Hatcher, who was there on the steps of Parliament House during Gough Whitlam's dismissal in 1975. Gough Whitlam passed away this morning at the age of 98. I've been really quite distressed to hear of the case of Jacqueline Sparks, the young first-time mum from Wollongong. She was involved in a terrible car crash which injured her and her brothers when a drug-affected driver crossed onto the wrong side of the road. The accident killed her 33-week unborn baby, and her uterus was also ruptured in the accident, leaving it almost impossible for her to naturally conceive again. Now, the driver got 6 years jail, but he couldn't be charged for the death of the unborn infant. And some of the judge's comments implied that he wasn't completely happy with that. Professor Michael Adams is the Dean of Law at the University of Western Sydney, and he can actually explain this to us. Hi, Michael.
Morning, Katrina. Yes, this is a complex area indeed.
Yeah. Well, why can't the drug-affected driver be charged for the death of the unborn infant?
Would you believe it dates back to 1828 when Australia adopted all laws from the United Kingdom. And the United Kingdom had a long-standing legislative framework, an Act of Parliament, which effectively said that an unborn child in uterus had no legal rights. And that has existed and said it was imported into New South Wales law as long ago as 1828. So this is a very long-standing legislative framework which would, in fact, tie the judge's hands.
So do you know what the reason for that would have been? Like, there must have been a logic behind it. What would you say that is?
I think there's two factors. One is this is a classic area of the interplay between ethics and morals and laws, and sadly justice falls off the end. And reality is, back in the sort of times I'm talking about, so we're talking about pre-Queen Victoria, obviously we didn't have the technology. If a baby didn't go full term, they weren't born. And so there was no way of recognising. I mean, we're talking for most of our listeners here, of course, a generation before ultrasounds and generations before any sort of electronic ability to look at. The only way of knowing a baby was or a fetus was alive was obviously by putting a stethoscope to the womb and listening.
Well, that's true. They wouldn't have even known had the baby been alive before or after in a lot of cases. Yeah.
So the law decided to go with a very clear, unambiguous law, which basically there are no rights prior to the baby being born, and if the baby is sadly born, stillborn, it is not recognised, even though obviously there are procedures to recognise it in terms of, it can be buried and have a funeral service, etc., but actually in terms of the eyes of the law, it as an individual has no legal rights.
I mean, of course, things have changed. We now, as you said, we've got ultrasounds, but also we can determine a lot more about the causes of death and things as well through autopsies. Do you think that this law could or should be changed to more accurately reflect that mother's loss?
Well, I believe the New South Wales Parliament is actually starting to look at this. Last year, a draft bill was entered into Parliament to actually look at it. I'm sure many of the listeners will know about Zoe's Law, which is effectively where there's a police chase and somebody unfortunately gets caught up in that chase and an unborn baby is killed. There was some recognition of the law. So in other words, society's attitudes have changed and politicians respond. Plus the technology, the whole law, as I said, prior to 20 weeks, obviously it's very difficult to keep a fetus which is born alive, whereas post 20 weeks nowadays, our medical science has moved such a long way that it's certainly in this poor little place, at 32, 33 weeks, there would be no reason why normally the medical staff could not affect the baby to grow to a healthy baby if this had not occurred. So I think a mixture of the technology and social society's changes could open up changes to the law.
I know certainly it's impossible not to feel for this poor mother and what she's been through, and that, you know, her loss should be fully recognised.
Absolutely. Yeah. The other big distinction is between criminal law and civil law. This was obviously a criminal matter, and we now know that the driver was high on drugs and a whole bunch of other factors, which hence why the six-year sentence has been imposed. But this doesn't change the mother's legal rights here to bring legal actions. And I think one of the reports I read was that she's unable to now have children. Well, that will have obviously long-term impacts, and that's compensation, and that's done on a completely different basis. So the listeners need to understand there is a big distinction between the criminal law and what the judge was talking about here, where his hands are clearly tied in recognition of any legal action by his child against a civil action, which does open up many more possibilities. I know money will never bring back that loss of life, but it may compensate in other ways, and that will be a separate matter.
Well, particularly if she might need some expensive fertility kind of treatments and things like that too. So
absolutely.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for explaining it to us, and we'll hold out hope for this poor woman yet. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Katrina.
That's Professor Michael Adams. He's the Dean of Law at the University of Western Sydney, just explaining that complex case to us. With the festive season just around the corner, it's time to start thinking about Christmas presents, holiday plans, and organising that end-of-year catch-up. And while it's always good to let your hair down and celebrate with family and friends, it can also be a stressful time financially. I know for myself, with a large family and all the extra social events, gifts, food and drinks and travel, it always seems to take a few months for the finances to recover afterwards. So how can we limit the financial damage of the Christmas New Year period? Scott Pape, a.k.a. the Barefoot Investor, has got some ideas. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you going?
Not too bad. Now, this is often a really bad time of year for people, isn't it? Why are we so hopeless at this time of year?
Well, it's a bad time for consumers, for retailers. This is the make or break part of the season. If you don't have a good Christmas period, so from saying it keeps getting earlier and earlier each year by the sound, by the feel of things. But from saying November right through to December, if you don't make the bulk of your money in that time, it's really lean for the retailers. And that's why there's so much pressure to get you to, to shop around that Christmas period. You know, often the first Christmas card that I get is from my bank saying, hey, would you like to increase your credit card? would you like another credit card? So, I think retailers and banks have become very attuned at the fact that people are going to be spending more than they earn around December that they haven't saved for it, and they really exploit that.
Look, we enjoy all that stuff. We like the presents. We like the going out for drinks and all that. So I'm not saying, we should all be like Scrooges or anything.
No.
But what are the common mistakes people make in terms of then leaving themselves with, I guess, a financial hangover next year?
As a father myself, I know that with kids it can be tough because you can talk about, getting them really nice experiences and stuff, but really they want toys. but for anyone else, a lot of people spend up big on stuff for family and friends. My view, my family's always done a Kris Kringle because, my view is, someone's going to spend $80 on me, like my uncle. Like, dude, just give me the money. You're not going to find anything that I can't buy myself anyway. So I think for adults doing the Kris Kringle thing, for kids, that's a whole different story.
Scott, seriously got about 20 nephews and nieces, and I buy every one of them a gift. I can't help myself.
That's why we decided, where I'm from, big country family as well, but we would do Kris Kringle for the adults.
Yeah.
And we say adult is anyone who doesn't believe in Santa Claus.
Yeah, exactly.
That makes it a bit easier. To a little kid who still believe in Santa, that's maybe okay. But I guess the biggest gift that I would be talking about is I don't mind actually going out and catching up with my mates and having a few drinks and spending money on experiences and connecting with people, but it's just whacking, you know, out $80 or $100 for each of your friends and stuff when really they can buy it themselves. So my view would be limit present buying, even as Scrooge-like as that sounds. Catch up and cook them dinner or something. It's probably going to be more meaningful to them than buying something that they probably could have bought themselves.
That's
the other thing is that the average Aussie's got about $5,000 in credit card debt. Now, that is about $1,000 a year in interest. I know that, you know, it's a bit of a cliche that a finance guy would go, come on, you know, seriously, but $1,000?
Yeah.
You're spending $1,000 to some banker paying off his BMW. It is just not worth it. So my view is to pay down credit cards. I really don't like it. I don't actually have credit cards myself.
So would you say it's a good idea to try and clear the credit card before Christmas so that they're not paying interest on stuff you've bought during the year and then start with a clean slate?
Yeah, you know, the really warped thing that banks have been really good at is I have people all the time say, I've paid down my credit card. So they feel like they've got another $5,000 to spend. They've been trapped into thinking that their credit card limit is their money. So my view would be, well, you know, I would encourage people to pay off their credit cards and then lower their limit so that you can't go, you know, you can't go over it, because that's the other thing. People always try and, you know, clear their credit cards in January, but then what happens is they just blow it out again. Suddenly it's maxed up to the limit again.
Totally.
So my view is just not even playing that game at all. And from January 1, what I would be doing is, maybe your mum and dad may have done this, two little tricks, very sort of 1970s, 1980s. But they used to have these things called the Christmas Club account, the Christmas savers, where you just direct debit, you know, $20 a week or something into a savings account. That is incredibly powerful. Second one is lay-by. Lay-buying, again, is just that idea of putting something away, putting some money down every week, and then slowly but surely biting an elephant one shoe at a time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that does sound old-fashioned, but it's better than paying interest, isn't it?
You know, you've got four companies that are making $27 billion a year. You know, you could look at it and go, yeah, who cares? You know, I've just got credit cards and stuff, and, you know, that's just the way it goes. But over 10 years, you know, you're going to pay, you know, more than $10,000 in interest payments. It just makes no sense. Like, that's a really, really cool holiday in New York. And
yep.
Just to get yourself sorted, you know, it takes you sort of half an hour to get all this stuff in place and put your savings on autopilot. My view is that that's just sort of, it just makes total sense to me.
Okay.
It's really, really powerful. So I would encourage anyone to do sort of a very barefoot Christmas this year and say, I'm going to be, you know, going to Dan Murphy's, I'm going to buy some booze, we're all going to have fun, but I'm not buying anyone any presents apart from little kids who still believe in Santa.
Okay. Thanks, Scott. Good
on you.
Thank you. Good to chat with you. Bye-bye. That's Scott Pape, a.k.a. the Barefoot Investor, talking about ways to limit the financial damage of the Christmas New Year period. You can find Scott online at barefootinvestor.com or on Facebook or Twitter. You're listening to the Hope Mornings weekly podcast. If you haven't yet, be sure to subscribe on iTunes to enjoy a new episode in your inbox every Friday afternoon. Still to come, we catch up with the founder of Sculpture by the Sea. We'll hear from Aussie pop star Paulini and we'll tackle the question of when to let your kids quit. Kids today are doing more scheduled activities than ever. It's not uncommon for primary school kids to play more than one sport throughout the year, learn a musical instrument, and then do something extra like acro or swimming lessons or school choir. But as a parent, what should our response be when our child says they want to quit? Should we make them stick it out for a set time period? Do we strike up some kind of deal? Or do you just give in because life's too short to waste time doing something you don't enjoy? Psychologist Colette Smart from Family Smart joins us. Hi, Colette.
Hi, Katrina.
The example of this that just springs to mind for me is like a little kid who's 5 or 6 or 7 and they're learning the piano or something like that and they never want to practice. They say they hate it. They want to quit. But you as the parent, you really want them to stick at it because you know that later on they might be grateful. You know, what do you do?
Like you said, it's not uncommon for kids to want to quit an activity. I think sometimes, you know, it could be a sports team, a musical instrument, a club. And it definitely causes a dilemma for parents. I know I faced it in my own home.
Mm.
There's not always an absolute answer to this, but there are several factors I think we need to consider before we decide it's time to quit this. So
okay.
I think things like, what do you want he or she to be learning from the art of not quitting. So things like old-fashioned perseverance, you know, we talk about life skills these days, and not quitting is a life skill. I don't think it's bad for children to start learning the value of commitment early on and sticking something out until they reach that phase of competency. We've got to realize we don't always enjoy everything all the time in our lives. So learning constancy, commitment, loyalty, and thinking of others as well. So, you know, not letting down your team is also important. So not quitting just because it's just hard for today or I don't feel like it. We can't do that in our jobs, in our daily lives. So it's a good skill to learn early on.
But what about, you know, one thing I struggle with is how do you tell the difference between when a child really doesn't like something, like they really don't like it, and when it's just a temporary hump? Because, you know, when you're little and you're learning a new skill, it is difficult, you know, particularly something like, for example, learning to read music.
Yeah, so I think it's important to look at your child's temperament. So are they a child who doesn't like to fail? So they'd rather not do something or try something too difficult so they don't fail? Or are they a perfectionist? Are they a shy child? One of my children hates anything new. So as soon as there's something tough that's coming up, the child will particularly rather back out. And I know that. So we've had to, with this child in our family, make this child push through the tough stuff because I know eventually it will become easier for them. So knowing your child's temperament, also sometimes looking at the reason why they want to quit. Is it just because they're bored for a little while, or is a coach yelling a lot?
Yeah.
And then also, do they just want to stay home and play video games? you know, one of the things we do know is video games have a reward factor of every 15.4 seconds in a game. That is not life.
No,
so,
it's true.
You know, it's important to also allow children, though, sometimes to actually make choices for themselves. So if you know your child is not a child who quits all the time, and this is not a pattern, and they have stuck it out, I think giving a season is fair. Six months is a long time for a child. If over the whole 6 months they have consistently said, I'm really not enjoying this, I think I want to step out now. As long as they're not just wanting to stay home playing or watching TV, if they choose something else, that's okay. I think it's looking at a pattern. If they keep wanting to stop something, I think that's when we have to think, okay, no, this is the child just not wanting to stick through things in general.
Yes.
And we need to push through.
That's really interesting, isn't it? So if you do have a child like that who either gets frustrated very easily, like you said, or they're perfectionists, so they don't want to do things they're not good at, or maybe even they struggle to kind of, like you said, deal with a new situation where they don't immediately have a best friend, you know, what are some positive ways, I guess, to encourage kids to persist?
I mean, sometimes you can have a short-term reward factor, like especially with little children, you do your star chart or your sticker chart that can help them just have some slightly more immediate rewards for a while. And then things just like asking them, what did you enjoy in the activity today? Or can you think of times when you have pushed through, what happened for you then? And give them little steps along the way that they can make small achievements.
Okay.
It is tough for some kids if they don't feel like they're the best on the team, but we're not always the best at everything. And I think as parents, we talk about helping our children to find their passions, but remembering passions don't happen overnight. They're the result of hard work and dedication. So helping our children see the value in things when we know they might not be old enough just yet or mature enough just yet. And we know the appreciation will come in time.
That's so true, isn't it? Because often as a parent, you know, we've got values, whether that's wanting a kid to go to church or go to Jewish school or learn about their culture or their language, you know, sometimes those things will take a long time before they will actually appreciate them.
Absolutely.
But in time they might,
And also to make sure our children are not overscheduled in the first place. I think that's also, you mentioned that in the beginning, but I think that's an important factor. If our children are doing too much already, then I think that's when it is okay to say, right, let's just choose one activity per season and we stick that out.
Totally, totally. Okay, thanks, Colette. Some good tips there.
Thank you.
That's Colette Smart, and you can find her online at familysmart.com.au. It's going to be a hot weekend. Perfect weather for a trip to the beach. So
why not take in some artworks as well? The 18th annual Sculpture by the Sea is on this weekend, featuring 109 sculptures from 16 different countries. David Handley is the founding director of the event. G'day, David.
Good morning. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Always excited about Sculpture by the Sea. Such a great day for, you know, the whole family. This year, we're hearing that the sculptures are bigger than ever. The giant frying pan, of course, bringing to mind. Is the exhibition on a larger scale this time around than usual?
It is the year of the biggest Sculpture by the Sea. You're absolutely right. There is a 45-metre long installation on Tamarama Beach with, the artist tells me, 6 kilometres of coloured nylon line. He's from Argentina. His name's Alejandro Propato, and it's creating the permanent sunrise. And it's just spectacular. But we still have the beautiful small works nestled amongst the rocks as you walk around. So there is something in all shapes and sizes, except the big ones obviously do stand out.
Okay. And is there a sculpture for you this year that, you know, that breaks new ground or something that you're particularly excited about, something a bit different?
There's one that I really adore by Kerry Argent from Western Australia. Kerry has created something like, it's like a mythological sea creature, a sort of giant slug called overconsumption.
Oh, and wow, yeah.
It's made of 80,000 recycled bottle tops and 320,000 cable ties.
Wow, we had bottle tops last year in a beautiful blanket, I remember.
Yes, yeah. Different artist, but many, many more bottle tops.
Yeah, fantastic.
And Kerry did a bottle top work a few years ago, so interesting that the two artists are working with that as a medium, because it's not exactly what you think of as something that artists work with.
Well, that's right.
And this work is draped over the rocks at the Bondi end of the coastal walk from Bondi to Tamarama, and I think it's spectacular.
Okay. We've also, one artist, Jeffrey Drake Brockman, has set an ambitious target for his piece, Counter. How does that work?
Every person who walks through Counter is picked up by a movement sensor, and there's two children in front of me now going through it constantly. So it's not going to be an accurate record of the number of people who come to Sculpture by the Sea.
No.
And every person who goes through it is registered, and the number changes instantly on the screen.
It's powered
by solar power. It's on Tamarama Beach, and I think it's shortly going to pass 10,000, and I think there'll be a cheer that goes up as these landmark figures are passed. But Jeffrey sent a wish list out of 1 million, although I think a journalist might have misheard him and heard 1 billion, but I think his list is the 1 million, not the 1 billion.
I saw 1 billion in the paper. I thought, that's going to be tricky. I also saw...
Chinese tourism isn't up that much.
I also saw a great comment by that artist, and it's interesting that you mentioned kids running through it, because he was saying how much he enjoys seeing children interact with his work, and that you know, kids today are so comfortable around art, which is something that I see a lot with my kids and their friends. And I was wondering, you know, when you originally founded this event, whether you could have imagined that you could have really such a big influence on a whole generation of kids who are now so enthusiastic about art.
Okay, confession time. I didn't think about children at all when I started this.
Yeah.
I was thinking about it for people like you and I, people who don't normally go to art galleries, or I'm sorry if I'm speaking out of school there for you, go to them occasionally. But love art, and it's just all a bit too hard. And I thought, let's take art to the people. Yeah. And the first year, I was so busy, didn't notice the children. The second year, I noticed the children. And ever since then, we've developed different ways to engage with children. We've got the kids guide. We've got our schools education program, which I'll just plug. We're without a sponsor.
Okay.
For that, 2,900 kids are coming through our program with artist-led tours, sculpture-making workshops with recycled materials, schools from all over greater metropolitan Sydney and around regional New South Wales. There's even a school that comes up from Victoria each year for that. It's a wonderful program.
I was at a kids' art exhibition just the other night, and there was a sculpture in there, a loom band sculpture, which actually won a prize. And I thought, wow, you know, I don't think when I was a kid I would have even thought of sculpture, but now it's just there in the general awareness.
Yeah, it's something which all of us who work at Sculpture by the Sea, you know, if I can show off, we're really proud of this. It's something which we didn't plan, and it's just happened organically, because for children, sculpture, which is life-size to you and I, is super-sized to them. And so Sculpture by the Sea is just this giant fantasy land.
Yeah.
And the highlight for me of every year is seeing the first young face just beaming at a sculpture.
Yeah.
And you just see that it's just expanding their mind as they look at this, and the whole world opens up in front of them. Exactly.
Yeah.
And before shows like Sculpture by the Sea, they were like opera singers without a shower.
Yeah. Exactly. All right. Thanks, David. Great to chat with you.
Thanks a lot for your time.
Okay. Bye. It's David Handler. He's the founding director of Sculpture by the Sea. It's on all day, every day until November 9. So get out and enjoy it. Well, UTS has pulled off a bit of a coup, getting Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak on board as an adjunct professor. His name might be a little less famous among the general public than Steve Jobs, but Steve Wozniak was there from the earliest days of Apple computers. Now, to tell us more about his contribution to modern computing, Andrew Morris, our new media manager, joins me. G'day, Andrew.
G'day. Good to be with you.
How significant was Steve Wozniak in the whole early development of Apple?
Was, as he's known.
Was.
Well, he was a key founder. He was the brains behind Jobs and himself. Jobs had the design, I guess, the design flair. He had the business acumen. And Woz had the engineering skills. And so
you're saying Steve Jobs couldn't have done it without Woz. Is that what you're saying?
That's
how it sounds.
Yeah. So Steve Woz was the guy that was helping build the, making the boards and the chips smaller and getting them. Steve Jobs could also do that as well. But so basically I think Jobs was at school, Woz was at the University of California. And they met through a mutual friend, and they got on well, and decided in the mid to early 70s to create Apple computers. So they started manufacturing these timber boxes and stuff.
This was literally in their basement, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, they say the garage, but Woz actually says no, that's not actually correct. They did it in their bedrooms, and when they were getting ready to sell and distribute the computers, they did that in the garage.
Okay.
So there's a few myths lying around how it all happened. But yeah, Steve Wozniak was instrumental in creating the first Apple computer, the first personal computer in the world, and then going and improving it with the Apple II computer, and then was also involved in the early design stages and development of the Macintosh.
Okay. I'm trying to think back to that movie they made about Steve Jobs. And was Steve Wozniak, did he stay with the company for quite a long time?
He's still a member. He's still on the payroll.
Oh, really?
He gets a small amount of money, which is probably a large amount of money in the scheme of Apple, but he's the first and probably will be the last, you know, like employee.
Oh, that would be nice. And how has UTS lured him over here to take up this adjunct professor role?
Well, since those days, he's gone and founded a few Electronic Frontier and a few other companies, and he's always had a love of education and always had a love for empowering kids to dream big and all that kind of stuff. And he also loves Australia. But this is the first time.
That's Australian music I've heard.
Yeah. Well, he's in the process of getting his citizenship and stuff. A little known fact, this is an aside, he actually was on Dancing with the Stars in America, which I found very funny.
Wow. I'd love to see that. Let's Google it.
But, he was wooed over to the UTS University of Technology in their sort of robotics department in the engineering side of things. It's called sort of their, I think they were tagging it their magic department kind of thing. So he has a love of educating and instilling vision into students. So this is right up his alley. And it's an adjunct position, so it's for a specific time, if you like. It's part-time. And he'll come over for certain periods of the year and also do stuff remotely with the students.
I heard it's all for free as well, but I don't know if that's true.
I don't know that.
This is pretty exciting, isn't it, for Aussie students to have access to...
Ah, it's a great boost to have, you know, a legend of computing, the co-founder of Apple Computers, to be able to draw knowledge from that person and be inspired by them. I think it's an amazing thing for Australian universities and stuff.
I think there's going to be a lot of 40-year-olds going back to uni.
I imagine you'll probably have the occasional open lecture, which would probably be pretty full.
It would. Oh, that's great. Well, I think that's exciting. And maybe in another 20, 30, 40, 50 years, we'll start seeing the fruits of this coming out with some of our own little innovative geniuses.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's an advocate for universities and an advocate that's where a lot of breakthrough technology will come through.
Yeah.
Larger companies don't have the time necessarily to do the massive breakthroughs. They can make sort of slight changes to technology, but universities, I think he regards as places where a lot of new ideas can come up.
Yeah, well, I think certainly just influencing the thinking of kids to dream big and try things, I think that's what you just couldn't get. You can't find that anywhere. Thanks, Andrew. Great to catch up.
Yeah, pleasure.
It's Andrew Morris, and we've been talking about Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak joining UTS as an adjunct professor. Exciting times. It's now more than 10 years since Paulinia was discovered in the first ever season of Australian Idol, a series that also launched the careers of Guy Sebastian and Shannon Knoll. She's now about to release her third solo album, Come Alive. Paulinia has travelled the world with her music in the past few years, but she's now back in Australia with a fresh new single. Hi, Paulinia.
Hello, how are you?
Well, thank you. Yeah, now you've done quite a lot in the last 10 years. You've had a number one album, played at some big events, and you've been writing songs for winners of The Voice. So out of all the stuff that you've done, when have you been most in your element? When have you sort of gone, yeah, this is really what I love doing?
Yeah, I had a moment in Paris while I was over there doing a sporting event, performing for a sporting event, and it was a massive arena, and I pretty much did my first song, a ballad, and the response I got was just phenomenal. Like, yeah, it was amazing. I can't even describe it. It was just, surreal, and that's when I kind of went, you know what? This is exactly what I should be doing.
Okay, so it's real. That was a live performance, though. That's interesting. So that's kind of when you really feel alive doing something like that.
Oh, that is, performing live is the most enjoyable part of the whole music industry for me.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And didn't you perform at the G'day USA Gala in New York City recently?
I did, yes. I was over in New York. I was finishing my album off. And I got a call from the guys that were, you know, obviously organizing it over there, and they asked me if I could do Come Alive, which is the actual title to my new album that's coming out. Yeah, and I performed that with myself and a piano and two backing vocalists, and it was beautiful. Like, I loved it, and it was amazing because I was, you know, performing in front of other Aussies who were very successful over there too.
And, come on, Paulinia, come on, do some name dropping. Who else was there? We want to know.
Weasley was there. Who else? There was a lot of, that actor in Gods versus Kings. I forget his name, but he's an Australian actor. There were a few sports people there, like soccer player.
Harry Cahill. Cahill, Tim Cahill, yeah.
They were there. I loved it. It was great to be around other Australians and perform for them. It was great.
Oh, look, obviously any Aussie artist would be thrilled to be, you know, included in an event like G'day USA. But what's still on your bucket list, Paulinia? Like, is there something that you would want to do that you haven't achieved yet?
For me, I think it would definitely just releasing overseas. I think for me, and getting it charted there, whether it's a good chart or not, but I'd love to just get my music out there and it chart. That would be the next step for me. I mean, and hopefully this album does that.
Is your goal the USA or the UK or Europe? What's more accessible? Asia, even?
Yeah. I think, my goal, all of it. I'm going to say all of it. Whatever comes first is what comes first and is meant to be. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, I know you've been writing for other artists, including some tracks for The Voice winners. But somehow in there you still found time to write your own album. So now that it's all done, can you see any threads of a theme that have emerged in the work that you've put into your own album?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's the most amazing thing about, you know, spending time and writing and writing what you're feeling and coming up with melodic lines that are you. Is that when you put them all together at the end of the year or whatever, it all makes sense. You know, there is a thread there, and that thread is you and your experience in all of these songs. And, you know, it's been 5 years. I've been writing and recording and trying to figure out me in all of this, because I think for my first two albums, I didn't know who I was musically. You know, I was kind of just thrown in there and I was told what to do and always kind of doing what made everyone else happy instead of me. So this time, you know, I really wanted to just take time out and improve my songwriting and improve all of that. You know, I even was part of the production of each of the tracks it was simple to just put all my songs together and go, you know, this is the direction I'd like these tracks to be going towards, and let's do that.
Okay. So even though this album is uniquely you, if you had to compare, what sort of sound can people expect?
It's pop. It's commercial, but now it's more of an adult contemporary pop okay. album.
Sure. Yeah. All right. Well, in just a sec, we're going to play the new single, Air It All Out. Do you want to tell us a little bit
Yay.
About this track? Yeah.
This is one of my favourite tracks on the album. I remember the time when I went over to New York and wrote this. I really was, just going through a bit of a rough patch with everything, really, my career, everything, and basically reminding myself that I have to let go of things before I can move forward. Mm. And that's what this song's about, just letting it go, airing it out, inhaling goodness and positiveness and moving forward.
Okay. Thanks, Paulini.
Thank you.
That's Paulini. We've been chatting about her new single and her new album. The single's called Air It All Out. It was released last Friday. Here it is now on Hope 103.2.
Alone inside this prison, these four walls closing in, I see a ray of light.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 103.2's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.